Thanks for coming to something after the reception. The good news is that this is pretty short. I think it's about 30 to 35 minutes at the most, so that shouldn't be so bad. I would like this to be the second half of a chapter, the first half of which would be the stuff on the Fairy Queen that I'm talking about tomorrow. I've never been able to get them both to go into the same argument, so I'm hoping this workshop might help me be able to do that. There's a little bit of everything in here. There's some history of science, some philosophy of science, some cognitive science, and some poetry. Poetry is the only one that I actually have any training in, so I also hope people can be helpful with the other parts of this. Okay. This talk is hopefully part of a larger project which argues that one of the most emotionally resonant implications of the scientific revolution of the 17th century was the creation of a gap between ordinary human experience of the world, what cognitive scientists now call intuitive science, and scientific explanations of how it worked. And I should explain that I'm using the term scientific throughout this paper, but really in the 16th century, the term would have been natural philosophy. It's just easier to say science, so that's what I'm saying. The scientific revolution was based on and could not have occurred without a radical abstraction of concepts about the world from direct experience of it. Emphasis on the development of empiricism as the basis of the new science has occluded our understanding of the significance of this gap between world and concept, since empiricism claimed to reconnect experience and scientific theory. But the gap began to appear in the 16th century before empirical methods were established. And our retrospective understanding of the importance of empiricism in scientific method leads us to overstate the extent to which 17th century empiricism actually gave access to scientific truth. My argument is that for many people living through this period of major epistemological change, a dominant experience would have been of a new and shocking disjunction between what appeared to be the nature of the universe and what some thinkers were beginning to posit about its real nature. Poets, and again, this is a claim, but I'm saying it as if it's true. Poets must base their poetry on a vision of the world and how it works, an intuitive vision. So it's no surprise that early modern poetry registers this epistemological shift in striking but often implicit and indirect ways. I want to sketch out why I think an emerging gap between experience and science was so important in early, I'm talking about England because that's what I know about, and I'll focus on the changing role of analogy in bridging that gap. Analogy, or what E.M.W. Tilliard called correspondence, and what Foucault called, more broadly, resemblance, has played a large role in our understanding of the shift from an essentially medieval world picture to the incipient modernity of the new science. Scholars have long argued that analogy functioned as the central structuring mechanism of the old epistemological system and was replaced in the 17th century by variously identity, difference, or mechanism, depending on who's telling the story. Resemblance, in Foucault's words, relinquished its relation with knowledge and disappeared, in part at least, from the sphere of cognition. Recently, however, cognitive scientists have reemphasized the central role of analogy in all human thought and language, even in scientific thought up to the present day. My paper will discuss the continuing role of analogy in the new science of the 17th century, arguing that an important epistemological change in the period was from a qualitative and causal to a structural view of analogy. Analogy functions throughout the early modern period to connect different disciplines, but the understanding of what an analogical relationship signified was radically changed. What scholars have traditionally called analogy in one form, qualitative analogy, formed the connection between observation and theory under the old system. Analogy in another form, structural analogy, became even more important and served to maintain a bridge between observation and theory once their direct connection had been severed. In the past, literary scholars tended to marvel at the strangeness of Aristotelian theories about the natural world and the analogical system of the Middle Ages and earlier Renaissance. ideas like the correspondences or analogies between the microcosm of the human body and macrocosm of the universe, extending to parallels between the four elements and four humors, seem far-fetched. Tillyard commented that much of the doctrine cannot but appear remote and ingenuous to the modern mind, which is quite annoyed by the numerical jugglings and fantastical equivalences that delighted earlier generations. More recently, critics following Foucault have also taken a negative view of the Renaissance system of analogies, arguing that it had a primarily regulatory function, working to support the system of hierarchies that structured the universe as well as society. As Jonathan Sade has put it, within this world of resemblances, the body lay entangled within a web of enclosing patterns of repetition. However, many historians of science have argued that and I should say that when I say Aristotelian science, I mean the works of Aristotle that were extant in the Renaissance, along with their medieval systematization and elaboration. So I mean that whole body of thought. Many historians of science have argued that Aristotelian science was dominant throughout Europe for so long because it coincided to a great extent with ordinary experience of the world. In Thomas Kuhn's words, Aristotle's system was far nearer to many primitive conceptions of the world than its ancient competitors, and it corresponded more closely with the evidence of unaided sense perception. Stephen Shapin has similarly noted that the questioning of Aristotelian theories of matter drove a wedge between the domain of scientific legitimacy and that of common sense. Our sense that the Aristotelian worldview was heavily reliant on analogy is, in a sense, itself an analogy. Since according to that system, the connections posited between appearance and reality were actual, not analogical. As one scholar notes, Aristotle wished to evolve a physical science of qualities in which material bearers of properties were therefore regarded as explanatory principles. Under this system, stormy weather isn't just analogous to the expression of human emotion. As Gail Kern Pastor has put it, the passions had a more than analogical relation to liquid states and forces of nature, because in this cosmology, the stuff outside the world, the stuff of the outside world and the stuff of the body were composed of the same elemental materials. Much ancient science, in other words, read back from observable phenomena to posit the invisible causes of things, constructing a qualitative connection between them, which we, now doubting the explanatory force of qualia, consider to be analogical. Galenic medicine, for instance, constructs a humoral theory of disease based on its observable symptoms, which often involve change of temperature and alterations in visible bodily fluids. If that's what you see, that must be what's causing it. Aristotelian science constructs its theory of the composition of matter from its sensible qualities and behavior, hot and cold, moist and dry, dense and rare. It constructs its mechanics from observations of the movement of objects in space. It accepts the Ptolemaic universe because the sun and planets appear to evolve around the Earth. These sciences then explain what they cannot see or feel by analogy with what they can directly experience. However, again, to restate what we recognize as analogy, they assume to represent a direct material or causal linkage. If matter appeared to be dry, dryness must be its essential property. This basis of explanation in analogy was then logically extended to construct theories that link the causes of all observable phenomena with each other. Microcosm must mirror macrocosm because both exhibit the same visible qualities, which must therefore have the same material causes. This Aristotelian system did a good job of explaining the constants in nature, but it couldn't easily account for change. If substances are defined by their qualities, and for example, the primary quality of water is its liquidity, how can it change into ice or steam, which have completely different qualities? As Stephen Toulmin has put it, any theory of the natural world must have two contrasted features. It must both give an account of the unchanging ingredients of things and explain how those unchanging ingredients can give rise to the changing flux we perceive. Some rival schools of natural philosophy in the ancient world formulated theories of atomism to better account for change. Paul Thagard has argued that the development of an atomic theory of matter in ancient Greece was a major conceptual change that must have been based on some form of analogy, since atoms couldn't be directly observed. According to this paradigm, the world is composed of tiny indivisible particles, and the interactions of these particles, the distances between them, their collisions and attraction, cause the changing properties of matter. Water, therefore, is sometimes liquid and sometimes solid because its atoms can arrange themselves differently under different circumstances. Aristotelian theories of matter, however, won out over atomic theories of in classical antiquity and were dominant from the High Middle Ages until the late 16th century, when some European thinkers turned once again to an atomic theory of matter as a way to explain change. Aristotle's account of motion was also firmly based in ordinary observed experience and also not very well able to deal with change. As Chapin suggests, Aristotelians conceived emotions in terms of the observed qualitative nature of objects. Bodies naturally moved so as to fulfill their natures, to move toward where it was natural for them to be. So, according to this theory, solid objects fall because it's in their nature to seek the center of things. Fire rises because it's in the nature of fire to seek the heavens. Aristotelian mechanics held that the weight of an object is a property of the object itself and determines the rate at which it falls. As Nancy Nersesian has argued, this theory fails to explain how an object continues in its motion after it's been separated from the source of its motion, a subproblem of the problems concerning the nature of change that was resolved only after Galileo and Newton came up with an inertial representation of motion. Several researchers have suggested that the naive or intuitive theories of motion that people develop based on their ordinary kinesthetic experience of the world are very similar to Aristotelian and medieval theories of motion and sharply at odds with Newtonian mechanics. John Clement has argued that the motion implies a force theory of mechanics that Galileo, as a precursor of Newton, was at pains to discredit, is still widely held today, and that it's probably rooted in everyday perceptual motor experiences like pushing and pulling objects. And as such, it belongs to our set of deeply seated mental models in the form of physical intuitions that can be very compelling and resilient. Michael McCloskey's research has shown that even students who have completed a college-level physics course can still retain naive concepts of motion at odds with the Newtonian mechanics taught in both high school and college courses. Alan Harrison and David Trigas have similarly shown that intuitive theories of matter also make it difficult for students to understand atomic theory. These perceptually grounded mental models are clearly similar to the conceptual metaphors that George Lakoff and Mark Johnson see as structuring human thought and language. It isn't surprising, then, that several of Lakoff and Johnson's primary metaphors are based in intuitive mechanics. Change is motion, actions are self-propelled motions, causes are physical forces. To the extent that the new science of the 17th century contradicted basic sensory motor experience, it opened up a gap between non-scientists and nature that has never been closed. As the familiar narrative goes, for centuries, those aspects of the observable world that didn't easily fit within the Aristotelian system of analogies were the wonders and marvels of nature, or were attributed to mysterious occult or hidden causes. By the 16th century, scientific thinkers began to fasten on certain phenomena that seemed especially resistant to explanation by extension from observed properties. Changes in states of matter, for instance, from solid to liquid to gas, were problematic because of the difference in basic qualities, which were supposed to be phenomena that determined the essential nature of each substance. The movements of bodies in space, such as falling objects and projectiles, didn't, in practice, accord with Aristotelian mechanics based on force and weight. At the same time, new technologies extended human powers of observation. Dissection allowed a previous view of the previously hidden interior of the body. The microscope and telescope extended the range of vision. Boyle's air pump allowed observation of the invisible properties of air. As a result of these new observations, scientists began to formulate theories that postulated causal properties that differed radically from what could be observed under normal circumstances or with the naked eye. Atomic theories of matter, for instance, better explained changes in states of matter, but they involved a radical disjunction between what was observed, materials that exhibited familiar properties of density, weight, solidity, and a world of tiny invisible bodies that formed the sensible matter and explained its behavior, but didn't exhibit the same qualities. The causes of things could no longer be explained by analogy with basic human experience of the universe. Historians of science have realized, of course, that the new philosophy assaulted common sense at a mundane as well as a cosmic level. John Donne's famous lines in the first anniversary have long been cited as providing evidence of this disturbance. The new philosophy calls all in doubt. The element of fire is quite put out. The sun is lost and the earth, and no man's wit can well direct him where to look for it. And freely men confess that this world spent, when in the planets and the firmament they seek so many new, they see that this is crumbled out again to his atomies. However, Lakoff and Johnson's insights about the centrality of concrete bodily experience to human thought raises the stakes. If new theories explaining the structure of the cosmos, matter, and motion were at odds with ordinary embodied experience of these phenomena, then the scientific revolution marked an unprecedented separation between the very bases of cognition and the specialized technologies of scientific thought. Analogy, however, still maintained an important role in the formulation and dissemination of scientific knowledge. Certainly, many writers and scientists continued to rely on qualitative analogies well into the 17th century. Many almost indiscriminately used both old and newer forms of analogy. Cognitive psychologists like Deirdre Gentner and Michael Jeziorski have established the continuing role of what they call structural analogy in contemporary science. In teaching, where electricity, for instance, is explained by analogy with flowing water. And in discovery itself, as in Ernest Rutherford's ability to conceptualize the structure of a hydrogen atom by analogy with the structure of the solar system. In these instances, the analogy does not posit a qualitative or causal relationship. Electricity isn't thought to look or feel like water or to be materially the same, but it rather maps a system of relationships from a visible domain to an invisible one. Water and electricity behave in similar ways in the relationship between pressure and rate of flow. Gentner has argued that the 17th century marked a shift in the kind of analogy operative in scientific knowledge. She contrasts with modern analogy the writings of 16th century alchemists, who took the Aristotelian system of correspondences to an extreme, ascribing causal powers to analogy, and holding that even symbols didn't just stand for their reference, but were identical to them in essence. The alchemical symbol for gold, for example, was a circle, because both the circle and gold were considered to be perfect. The perfection of the symbol was thought to reflect, in essence, the perfection of its referent. Writers like Robert Boyle and Johannes Kepler, on the other hand, evince what Gentner calls modern attitudes toward scientific analogy. Boyle, for instance, in his treatise of the great effects of even languid and unheeded local motion, argued for an atomic theory of matter against men who undervalue the motions of bodies too small to be visible or sensible. Because such small particles cannot be seen, they can only be understood through analogy with what is visible. On the other hand, Boyle breaks with tradition by asserting that the visible surface of matter doesn't directly reveal its composition of particles. The nature of the particles he seeks to explain by analogy with ants moving a large pile of eggs, or the action of wind in trees, analogies which don't depend on essential similarity. He doesn't argue that the particles actually resemble tiny little ants, but in Gentner's words, the analogies are about common relational systems. Boyle can imagine the way that invisibly small particles can cause large-scale effects by imagining the ability of ants to move a huge pile of eggs. The analogy reflects the structural relation of an accretion of small individual actions. Kepler, similarly, advocates use of analogies in geometry, where again, in Gentner's words, the analogy is useful in virtue of its ability to capture common causal relations and not an essential identity. The epistemological shift that accompanied the rise of the new science in the 17th century then involved not an end to the use of analogy for scientific thought, but rather a change in the nature and uses of analogy in that context. I want to use the rest of this talk to explore two implications of viewing the shift in this way. The first implication involves awareness of the ongoing role of analogy in science. Of course, historians of ideas have long acknowledged that the concept of a mechanistic universe was itself an analogy. And we can now recognize it as an analogy that posited a contiguous causal relationship among the parts of the material universe rather than an analogical one. It's an analogy that undoes analogy. We might even follow Bruno Latour in suggesting that the relationship between the data produced in the artificial conditions of the laboratory and the natural world is representational. Aristotelian science actually didn't allow experiment because experiment was thought to involve a sort of unique circumstance, whereas truth about nature could only be revealed by what ordinarily happened every day. So it makes sense that you could view the relationship between data produced by an experiment as an analogy for what actually happens every day in the real world. Boyle's air pump produced observable results. A bird placed within its evacuated chamber would die from lack of oxygen. The scientist, however, must extrapolate from that result to posit a universal theory about the nature of the atmosphere. He must assert that the visible events inside the apparatus represent facts about the composition of air. The vacuum apparatus provides observable symptoms of otherwise invisible phenomena, which can be extended by analogy to posit facts about the nature of the atmosphere. From this perspective, the scientist isn't simply discovering the nature of reality directly, nor is he constructing it. He's mapping an analogy between a smaller, controlled representation of the world onto the whole in general. Awareness of the 17th century transition to structural analogy in science can also help us understand what has traditionally been called metaphysical imagery in a different way. Critics like Marjorie Hope Nicholson tended to read early 17th century poetic imagery as manifestations of the old analogical system. So she reads Donne's twin compasses in the poem Valediction Forbidding Morning is probably the archetypal metaphysical image. And Nicholson reads that image as a manifestation of the old analogy of the circle of perfection. And she says, more completely than in any other symbol in the universe, the great geometer has shown the intricate relationship of the three worlds in the repetition of the circle of perfection. And W.A. Murray similarly drew a connection between Donne's gold to airy thinness beat and the compasses through the alchemical symbol for gold, a circle with a dot in the center, which Gentner considered to be a prime example of the older version of qualitative analogy. Donne's compasses in this reading liken the love between the speaker and his absent beloved to the perfect circles of gold and of the cosmos. I think the image of the compasses makes more sense as an example of a newer style of structural analogy. Its quality of yoking together two unlike things, the souls of the lovers and a mathematical instrument, is a function of the fact that it doesn't posit an essential similarity between the two terms, but instead indicates only the relationship between two joined but divided poles. It is simultaneously an example of a structural analogy and also an image of one, since its focus is on the process of creating the circle that represents perfection. As a result, its relation to the concept of circular perfection is more complex than critics have realized. As various critics have argued in different ways, the poem as a whole is in part about the relationship between body and soul, or to rephrase this, between the sensible and the abstract. The poem is basically the speaker, for in case there's anybody in the world who hasn't read it. The speaker is going away on a trip, and he's telling his beloved not to get upset. Right? Is that accurate? Yes. So the speaker begins by likening his separation from his beloved to the separation of the soul from the body after death. And the poem starts off, as virtuous men pass mildly away and whisper to their souls to go, while some of their sad friends do say the breath goes now and some say no, so let us melt and make no noise, no tear floods or sigh tempests move, toward profanation of our joys to tell the laity our love. Although the speaker's comparison of his separation from his beloved to a death is surprising, if he's trying to convince her not to make a big deal out of his absence, comparing it to death is certainly, surely not a very effective strategy. So it's surprising, but it's still a qualitative analogy, because the final exhalation of breath that was thought to contain the departing soul, and because the exhalations of lover's sighs contain the spirits that communicated between soul and body. The speaker refers to the conventional analogy between microcosm and macrocosm when he mentions tear floods and sigh tempests. He just compresses it. But he uses that reference hyperbolically, and I think ironically, to suggest that the process of making the invisible visible through outward signs is problematic. He's trying to get her to shut up, right? So he's saying, don't do the tear floods and the sigh tempest. Dunn calls on the Aristotelian belief that weather and human emotion are qualitatively the same. But he does so in order to advise against representing inner reality through outward appearance. He essentially turns a direct link, sighs and tears, tempests and floods are manifestations of similar disturbances of the humors and the elements, into an analogy by speaking as if the link were under the addressee's voluntary control. Their love should be kept private, not manifested visibly like the weather. He goes on at the end of the poem to offer two different accounts of the relationship between his soul and his lovers. He then shifts to arguing that they're not really going to be separated. Or, you know, so he says, well, either our souls, we have just one soul, or we have two souls. And if we have one soul, this is why we're not separated. And if we have two souls, this is why we're not separated. So he makes two different arguments. And so he offers two different accounts of the relationship between his soul and his lovers, and each is represented by a different analogy. If their souls are united into one, they're like beaten gold, like when a goldsmith pounds on a piece of gold and flattens it out into gold leaf, because they spread, but there's no gap or breach. So that's if they're one. They're like beaten gold. If the two souls are separate but connected, they're like compasses, like a, you know, like from geometry class where you use a compass to draw a circle. The first analogy of the soul with beaten gold is basically a qualitative analogy. Their joined souls share with the gold qualities of extension without gaps, preciousness, perfection, even airiness. There's no mention of an atomic substructure that would introduce invisible gaps into the gold. He's not going to go there. But he follows this with another analogy. Their souls, if they're two, they're like compasses. And by choosing two such different analogies for the two souls, he may suggest that the analogies aren't qualitative because the gold and the compass are so different, but instead structural. Each represents a different relationship between the two souls. The second analogy of the compass seems to me fully structural, since the souls have nothing qualitatively in common with a mathematical instrument. Hence the discomfort that readers like Samuel Johnson have felt with the poem, and hence the sort of memorableness of the image. The differing materiality of the gold and the compasses is crucial here. Although both have traditionally been associated with circular perfection, and that's why readers of this poem for years have wanted to see them as the same, versions of the same thing. The emphasis in the second analogy is on the material process of creating the circle that represents the goal. Jess Edwards has shown how early modern mathematics and geometry in particular were situated in a vacillation between the ideal and the material. Tracing forward from Neoplatonism, a tradition in which mathematical figures such as the circle are merely analogic props or worldly analogies for existential primacy. He argues that medieval and early modern mathematical thinkers, as we have seen, began to conflate analogy with reality and to consider triangles, circles, and so on, not just as metaphors for or images of the material inhabited by the ideal, but also as a third realm of being and a stepping stone between the temporal and the absolute. The mathematician Thomas Harriot, for instance, speculated that geometrical points were identical with the invisible particles of atomic theory, points were atoms, a hypothesis which proved an obstacle to his progress in geometry. Unfortunately, it's an interesting idea, but it's totally wrong. Like, that's what's so wonderful about 16th century ideas about the natural world. John Dee, in his preface to a 1570 edition of Euclid's Elements of Geometry, which is a wonderful, if you haven't read it, you should read it. It's amazing, and I think more people in the 16th century read it than we maybe have recognized. Dee articulates the view that things mathematical represent a third being between the natural and supernatural because they are, and this is what he says, they are things immaterial and nevertheless by material things able to be somewhat signified. He contrasts pure geometry, which can allow men to be holpen and conducted to conceive, discourse, and conclude of things intellectual, spiritual, and eternal. He contrasts that with practical geometry, which is derived from true geometry and which is the art of measuring sensible magnitudes by due applying of compass, rule, square, yard, L, perch, pole, line, gauging rod, or such like instrument. The instruments of practical geometry are the means by which the invisible and immaterial forms of geometric truth take on visible material reality. They are, that is, the means of constructing an analogy, which Dee's language reflects when he begins instructions for the practical use of geometry by physicians with, first describe a circle whose diameter let be an inch. The fact that Dunn focuses on the compass in the act of describing a circle rather than on the circle itself is highly significant. Rather than depicting the invisible circle of perfection, Dunn shows the mechanical and imperfect process of representing it. John Ficero, in a 1963 essay on this poem, calls attention to a passage from one of Dunn's sermons where he contrasts human life with eternal life. This life is a circle made with a compass that passes from point to point. That life is a circle stamped with a print, endless and perfect circle as soon as it begins. Ficero argues that Dunn's circle in the poem traces the emblem of a union of body and soul that cannot be perfect while it remains disembodied. I would shift emphasis slightly to suggest that Dunn's focus is on the process of creating an analogical relationship between visible and invisible, material and immaterial. In a poem that argues, finally, for the incommensurability of the visible and invisible, Dunn's speaker scorns human lovers whose experience of the insensible consists solely of analogy with physical qualities, things which elemented it. In this poem, the speaker wittily applauds the disjunction between experiential reality and an invisible spiritual reality that lies behind it or beyond it. The soul cannot be understood as qualitatively like the body, but only as sharing a structural relation with it. The compasses are shown in the act of drawing a circle, and it is this process, rather than the circle itself, that conveys the structural relation. The compasses turn out to be a metaphor for the poem itself as it calls attention to and problematizes its own process of drawing analogies between invisible and visible things. Dunn, of course, often relies on the older system of analogy. And in fact, I think for poetry, that older system was an incredible treasure trove of images, and that's why people kept using it long past the 17th century. But I do think his most striking metaphysical images participate in the new epistemology that I've been describing. Understanding analogy in both science and literature from both cognitive and historical perspectives gives us a finer instrument for seeing how they work. If we replace a dichotomy between resemblance and difference with a subtler understanding of the ways in which analogy wields both, we can better read the traces of earlier structures of thought wherever we find them. Yes.